Thank you, Francesca, and thanks, Ravi, for having me over. The very specific questions that Francesca and Ravi raise in the blurb of the conference, and also in some sense at this moment, the questions of where have we gone from Chutneyfying English, which came out about 5 years ago, first as a conference and subsequently as a book. I'm not addressing those questions right away. I mean, it's anyway somewhat, I think, narcissistic, if not dumb, to sort of talk about your work and discover even more flaws than you thought there were. So I don't want to do that, but I'm hoping that through what I'm going to say, some of which is organized and some is not, I'm hoping that my own concerns since Chutneyfying English and my own sort of positioning of Hinglish in some of the larger sort of debates that I engage with today will emerge in this slightly free-flowing talk that I'm about to give you. Let me sort of begin by also sort of responding to Snehlata's work. Is she here? I didn't get a chance to sort of talk to her after her presentation, but I think what I'm about to sort of narrate to you will also situate not only the kind of dilemmas that Snehlata faces in the classroom, but I think it might also help us unpack and open up, I think, some of the, if I may use the word, limitations of our Hinglish discussion 5 years ago and perhaps even today. I had an opportunity very recently to go for the nth time to Ganesh Devi's Bhasha Center in Chota Udaipur. For those of you who don't know, Professor Ganesh Devi had established this tribal research center in Gujarat, where he works with tribal languages and so on. And I had a chance to spend some time there and attend some of the classes that were going on. And you had these little children from various tribal communities. So you had children from Mehewali, you had children from Wasawi, you had children from Gamit, and four or five other tribal languages. The teacher herself is from a tribal community. And all the pedagogy in that classroom was entirely through the languages those kids speak, without any one language, Hindi or English or even Gujarati, as a master narrative. So you would have these students who would be asked that this is what we call such and such in Mehewali. What do you call it? And whatever the student said would be written on the board. And in some sense, the kids were the makers of knowledge. The kids are the makers of those categories. It is, in my experience, the most multilingual classroom I have ever encountered. And there was English in this. English figured accidentally, sometimes insidiously, sometimes invisibly, in little words that kids would have used, and they would say, board par tame aa nathi lakhyu. And they would use words like board, or they may use words like, you know, slate or whatever. And I think this is what I want to sort of emphasize, which is that our conversation about Hinglish needs to take place in the larger multilingual matrix in India. It is one element of a much larger story. It's true that as vehicular languages, both Hindi and English do play a very important role in India. And as I was talking to Apurva Anand yesterday, it is possible to mobilize one or the other in most situations and somehow get by, which says a lot, which by itself is a very significant phenomenon. But that being said, it's equally important to know what surrounds these languages. What are the other shadows that lurk over Hindi and the shadows that lurk over English, so that a pure English is also, in an implicit way, an absence of some other language that ought to be there. So there are, I want to sort of begin first by complicating the idea of language, which I think was not sufficiently complicated in Chutneyfying English. And what Chutneyfying English also did not do was to go into some of the finer, variegated sort of discussions of the Avdhi and Maghi and Haryanvi that emerged in the workshop here over 2 days. But all of that really builds up to say this, which is that languages as we understand them today had different socio-political meanings at the end of the 19th century. Technologies of enumeration, such as the linguistic survey, dictionaries, grammars, and a set of border-making practices have since then consolidated a sense of what Hindi or Bengali is. Attending upon this consolidation is also a recognition, whose grounds are contestable, that Bengali is not Ashmiya or that Hindi is not Avdhi, but rather hegemonic sources of the two. And yet in everyday conversations, such boundaries encounter defiance of textual definitions. Now you may ask what this has to do with English, a phenomenon or set of practices studied independently most of the time, or at least most of the time. Although the chapter on Tamil and Nagamese in Chutneyfying English and some interventions yesterday, for instance, reminded us to see English as a part of India's larger and mostly untheorized multilingual matrix, multilingualism, a word that I spend much time with these days, but continue to feel dissatisfied because it is used generally in passive ways, almost as a, if I may say, happy coexistence of different languages jostling cheek by jowl like different communities living in a chawl. But I like to understand multilingualism in its social effects and manifestations, so that it's not enough for a Gujarati to live next to a Marathi-speaking person, but whether the katori of one house is found in another, permeating its cuisine and dislodging the continuity and certitude of what constitutes Gujarati or Marathi cuisine. English has come to mean this metaphor, a disruption of steadfastly held linguistic cultural identities. In its metaphoric role, English is not merely about Hindi and English. How can it be, considering we know that institutions of so-called Hindi and so-called English are also historical creations? And yet what survives is the recent memory of language definition rather than its most natural pre-taxonomic existence as an aggregation of spoken and written acts which may have a perceptible pattern, but also a history of sealing boundaries. For instance, Gujarati became Gujarati by both territorial and linguistic boundary making, closing its borders in the north from Rajasthani, an entity that Grierson claims to have invented. In the south, it had to separate itself from Marathi to claim the Dangs, mobilizing in the process discrete nationalities to Marathi and Gujarati. With this background in mind, let us appreciate what English does to this plurilingual mosaic of the many things that signify. For instance, English, I think clearly, stands out as one disaggregable element, if such a word exists, in its aspirational quotient, and this embeddedness creates a spate of creolizations. Words such as Hinglish, Binglish, etc. tend to sound jocular, but the phenomena they represent are fascinating, hence the significance of questions that Francesca and Ravi ask. I do want to state here that our relationship with English, a phenomenon that has fascinated me now for over 2 decades, and in this case, the relationship of English with Hindi was the vantage point that I was coming from during Chutneyfying English. And this strand has continued to occupy me, of which English is now but one expression of the many. What opportunities does English have for reinvention and self-translation, whether that happens by using English words or abandoning the so-called mother tongue or defying the hegemonic regional language? All of these go to the reconfiguration of the linguistic economy of which English is very often the sutradhar. So I do believe very strongly that it is not possible to talk of English without talking of the quote-unquote other, and the other is a shifting signifier, and I don't need to substantiate what the many signifiers would be. As for some of the more specifically English observations that have emerged here, I will touch upon some that recur. For instance, is it innocent? Is it villainous? Is it both? Is it good? Is it bad? Is it a language? Is it an idiolect and so on? I find these questions somewhat tangential to the discussion, because the histories of many so-called languages may show us that they would not test the tyranny of a logocentric standard. To me, therefore, the question of whether English is a language or not is neither here nor there. While linguists may worry about it, I do not take that worry upon myself. But the collection of unself-conscious and conscious, of the kind that Vineet Kumar pointed out, inputs into English is not very different, for instance, from the way Gujari, again a language, a creolization, a phenomenon in 17th century Gujarat, takes place. The inexorable will to be heard and to persuade, to sell and to convince, creates strong enough desire for an idiom or a language to be created. So let me just sort of give you quickly a sense of what I'm talking about. Around the 17th century, Ismaili peers in the region of modern-day Gujarat mobilized Siraiki, Sindhi, Arabi, Gujarati, and extended the word of God to several people. And around the same time, in the region that is now Sindh, Shah Abdul Latif was using the colloquial languages and folk stories. Eknath was doing that in Maharashtra. In the kasbas, markets of products and ideas, you take what you can to sell. Hinglish is one in the series of kasba languages. I had recently an opportunity to revisit a satsang which I used to frequent as a very lost 18-year-old, go with my mother to hear this couple from Bombay that called itself Geeta Bhagwan and Shyam Bhagwan, and that gave you this very art of living, sort of feel good kind of little spiritual message. And I was stupider than I am now. So it's only recently when I revisited, I realized that even the language of the satsang, for instance, the accent is very, very Sindhi. The language is Hindi officially, although you hear Sindhi all the time because it's spoken in such a manner, and it is something like this. To humko ab bhagwan aise bolta hai ki aap chupchap baithe raho mere ko yaad karo, lekin aap mere ko yaad karte nahi ho, aur fir aap aise bolte ho, lekin humko guru ne aise sikhaya hai ki nothing is new under the sun. Kya bola? Guru ne sikhaya hai ki kuch bhi naya nahi hai. आपके घर अगर किसी की मौत हो गई तो वो नई नहीं है, वो सबके घर होती है. असं ये चौंदा ही ना. And then there is Sindhi, and then there is some English, and so the shadows of these several languages that lurk even in an utterance of this nature, I think, complicate the idea of mixtures in a way that they cannot be reduced to an either or situation, or even reduced to bilingualism. I find bilingualism as one of the most, if you like, simplified discourses today. It's not our burden. I think we need to continue to talk about multilingualism, because there is no pure bilingual situation. So English, as I said, is one in the series of these kasba languages, and the shadows of other languages also lurk even as the utterance seems mono or bilingual. And yet in invoking essences, for instance, of the many times that I listened to radio, I had heard on the news recently the news reader in Gujarati saying something, emni same kanuni karyavahi karvama avi. Na kanuni, this Gujarati news reader, a 20-year-old, would not realize, comes to us from a certain vocabulary, right, of the Gujarat Sultanate, of the Persian vocabulary that Gujarat itself had an encounter with. And then the next sentence is said, Srimati Anandi Ben Patele khas kidu che ke apro sanskritik varso jadvine rakho joye. Srimati Anandi Ben Patel has stressed that we must preserve our cultural heritage. This very conscious invoking of cultural heritage through words like Sanskritic Varso, but in the same utterance also unknowingly sort of communicating this very hybrid history of Gujarati itself, of which Gujarat is most amnesiac about. So that in a recently held Gujarati Literature Festival, you had a panel about, oh, should we mix Gujarati and English almost as if it's a matter of choice? And all the campaign, even when, you know, the organizers are talking about the festival, they are using a mixture of Gujarati and English. But then you would have this panel, and the panel is completely oblivious of the fact that you cannot speak two sentences in Gujarati without taking recourse to some Persian words, or sometimes some Arabic words, and so on and so forth. And yet these mixtures remain, I think, we remain amnesiac about them. There is almost a different forgetting and a different remembering. And I sometimes wonder whether English is not so real, which is why perhaps we organize seminars around it. If it was so real, we would have forgotten it exists as a mixed whatever. The very fact that it continues to draw our attention would perhaps mean that it's a mixture that's not complete. I don't know. I also think that it might be interesting to talk about sort of subliminal forms of Hindi Urdu that sort of obtain, that continue, that persist even when we do not actually sort of speak Hindi or speak Urdu or use Hindi or Urdu. That there's a certain way, for instance, by which, whether it is bhajans by Hari Om Sharan or whether it is Anup Jalota or somebody else, the song, the bhajans would be embedded upon a received memory of Hindi film songs. You do not even need to know those film songs, or for perhaps knowing them might make you receive those bhajans much better. But I think there is a certain way by which those memories are also sort of embedded and subliminal, and it might be interesting to see what happens at those invisible levels. There's generally a sort of a lot of discussion about the various repertoire, the sources out of which English comes to us, right? Or out of which English comes to us in, let's say, a Hindi utterance or in our language. And we know technology is one huge source and so on. And if you refuse to say samrachanavad for structuralism, which I recently did in a Gujarati lecture that I gave, and I said structuralism, and I had these Gujarati literary types saying, but Rita Ben, there is a word that exists for... I said, no, that word does not exist. You coined it and I refuse to use it. There is sometimes in using those words, a refusal to translate. And I think it would also be quite interesting to look at English from the prism of translation, almost as a refusal to translation. While there are these many other sort of sources, repertoire we talk about, I find it sort of more... I find it more interesting to see what kind of morphing... of the self that takes place, for instance, through English, in utterances that might be seen as Indian language utterances. I mean, for instance, the example of saying I love you in English has been sort of done to death, and we all know it, and we all laugh, and so on and so forth. And I find actually Madhav Prasad's theory sort of quite convincing, where he says you needed to say that to be able to sort of graft that outside a certain feudal structure, and these words would be said never in the domesticity of a house, but they would always be said in an offshore location against snow-peaked mountains and wearing beautiful clothes and so forth, almost as if their relationship with the kind of domesticity of the rest of the film had to be consciously created sort of in this manner. So that, for instance, in a film like Namesake, Jhumpa Lahiri's novel, which was made into a book and so forth, and he's saying to her, you never said anything to me. And Tabbu Irfan Khan says, and she says, kya matlab, kya bulwana chahte the tum mujhse? And he said, nahi, tumne bola nahi mujhe. And finally, the meaning dawns upon her. She said, acha, wo wala jo filmon mein bolte hain, I love you. So I think this kind of utterance, I think, continues to be somewhat outside. While it may not, I'm not saying that there is... that there is no significance to it. But I think that significance has been numbed by overuse. But more interesting, I think, expressions are those when an alienated couple talks about itself and saying, "Hamara wavelength match nahi hota." Right? I find that more sort of convincing and more real in some sense, not as something that has been inserted through a certain set of institutionalizing processes, but as one that does not even draw attention to itself. We don't even notice that someone is talking about a deep matter here, an alienation in a marriage, but not saying, "Ne humko ek dusre se duri lagne lagi." You say, "Mera wavelength match nahi hota." Or when young girls go on to say, "Yeah, mujhe bhi meri space chahiye," and they are not saying this only in Hindi. They are saying this in Gujarati, they are saying this in Malayalam, they are saying this in Bangla. Why are they using the word space? Why would they not say jaga or jaga or jagya? You know, I think those technologies do demand sort of more attention, because they tell us something about fashioning of the self. And I think we sort of need to perhaps pay more attention to it. So really speaking, where are we now situated, I think, with the Hinglish debate? I believe that this workshop has opened up many more domains than Chutneyfying English had done. For instance, Chutneyfying English did have people from the advertising world, it had people from cinema. Some of the discussions that we had yesterday in the context of cinema, Nandita Das talks about how a certain pressure of the market makes you call Firaq a Hindi film, but Firaq is not really a Hindi film. It's a very multilingual film, right? It's even got a dialect that certain kinds of Muslims speak in Gujarati. On the other hand, a film like Der Ishkia, most people came away saying, "We didn't understand. It required subtitling." So, I mean, I think the idea of language is very, very complicated. What appears to be sort of very comprehensible and all evidently there and accessible sometimes is not so accessible as we think it is, and sometimes it's the other way around. Differences between languages, for instance, which very often in a homogenized sort of state function appear to be the same language, are vastly different. No average Gujarati would understand a Kachhi. And when a Kachhi wants to talk business and wants to be official, I heard while working in a library in Bhuj someone saying in Kachhi to another person on phone saying, "Yeah, so say this to your boss, okay, and don't say it in Kachhi, say it in Gujarati, that you will not tolerate this anymore." Which means you clearly recognize that these are two different languages, although the official language is Gujarati, although Kachhi does not figure anywhere. And yet in the very same state, when I go into parts of Kachh and I think I'm speaking Sindhi, the Kachhis think I'm speaking Kachhi. Because such are the borders of languages that one bleeds into the other and without sort of knowing as to what is what. So very often the constitution of these differences is political rather than linguistic. And therefore I think it might be a good idea to sort of go back in some sense to roots of language making and border making, both at the level of territory, at the level of rhetoric, so that even, I think, antiseptic words like borrowed from, loaned from, which I increasingly find extremely exasperating. What is to say that Gujarati borrowed from Persian? Are you going to give it back? I mean, I think these are very antiseptic, seemingly innocuous ways by which you sort of reinforce a certain essential character of a language and sort of create this amnesia about its various cultural encounters as to what would be the forms of remembering and forgetting of this thing called Hinglish remains to be seen. Thank you.
Right, thank you. Let's see. Francesca and Ravikant are very clever people, so they must have had a very good reason for inviting me, right? Despite the fact that I felt kind of incongruous and, you know, out of my depth in very many of the talks that have been given here. I trust in their judgment that there must have been something that I they expect me to do. I'm also grateful to Rita for having done, given such a sort of professional kind of digest, really, of our deliberations over the last 2 days. And so that sort of absolves me in some sense of any kind of larger responsibility. And I would therefore basically like to touch on a few points that have come up in the last couple of days, which I think we need to bear in mind, and which I suspect might might need to be underlined and flagged right now. The first of these is something that we talked about yesterday, which has to do with the affective range of English, you know. And I'm glad that we've actually in our deliberations gone beyond the kind of parodic, mocking, satirical mode of talking about it. But I think the question still remains of what are the potentials of this language, and whether its affective range can actually encompass tragedy, which is the question we raised yesterday. And I think Rita and I were talking about it, and she spoke about the kind of the serious and somber context in which English is used, because it's not used by people in any sense in a kind of sort of self-mockery, self-satirical way. And I think the point is a valid one, that you know that people use language in serious contexts, but I think I would still like to distinguish between kind of the seriousness of the contexts in which the language is, so to speak, being made, and the adequacy of the language in order to be able to carry that. And you know, and this is a kind of difficult point that for me it's difficult. I can't think my way through it, because the problem is the artistic one in some sense of representing the tragedy of inarticulacy. I'm sorry to betray my high cultural roots, but I'm coming back to the sense of, you know, is it sort of, you know, it's kind of bilingual incompetence which in some sense generates these hybrids. That now, but having said that it is the problem of the representation of inarticulacy, I'm reminded immediately of the opening pages of the opening sort of 10, 20, 30 pages of Color Purple, where in fact it is precisely inarticulate, rubbed down, bare, reduced language which actually conveys the tragedy of the consciousness that is being sought to be represented. In some sense I'm contradicting myself. I'm saying that, you know, maybe it is possible, but maybe it has possible but not yet realized, that in fact the uses that we have encountered have not extended the affective range of the language in directions in which it may be able to go. Okay, so this question of the affective range is one that I would like to put on the table. I used to do it with my lectures on Desani, and ever since then, you know, that no matter what the level of kind of linguistic competence one brings to it, is it possible to do more than make fun? You know, and if yes, then what does it mean for what we are trying to do? Okay, one other question that has come up, but again needs to be flagged, I think, is the question of the need to historicize English, even as a set of practices, to locate it in a kind of, historical context, changing historical context, in changing situations within the same historical conjuncture, because as we were told yesterday, right, that it's not a language we are talking about, but a set of practices. And so those practices obviously mean different things in different contexts, as indeed was illustrated also in Francesca's talk this morning. So, you know, for instance, I mean, the question that again came to my mind was that Hinglish is in some sense an embrace of English. All right, it's a kind of, but is it a kind of, the pull is towards English, but is what it is getting away from Hindi? Is there a kind of push factor as well, that a kind of avoidance of high Hindi which actually drives this, you know? And I think, you know, for instance, I mean, in the radio programs that we were talking about, you know, where the unsympathetic characters are the ones who speak in this kind of high, pure dialect, whereas it's a more friendly, affable, cordial thing to do to mix it up a bit and so on. So, you know, so I think more attention to what is the Basically, languages crystallize against something. There is always another against which languages define themselves. And I'm just curious about what are the languages against which these hybridizations are happening. You know, so basically bringing the multilingual in again, both has a context of attraction and as a context of repulsion. You know, both as a context of embracing and as a context of avoiding. So, you know, so that. Something else that I wanted to talk about, which I thought about actually this morning when there was all this talk about, again, the TV programs and the Channel V and representing people who are, you know, working for addressing a generation which is career-oriented. And I thought, you know, it sounds plausible enough. Yes, it's certainly career-oriented, but we are talking about, and indeed these programs are talking to, a generation which is unemployed in unprecedented levels. So that, you know, it's curious. I mean, so that what does employment mean? You know, and I think there was some reference to that also, that, you know, whereas there is a world of work and there's a DM who goes to thing, but you never see what the DM does. Or someone goes to America and gets an education, but you don't know what the education is. So, you know, so I mean, the larger question to me is that a word that has sort of dogged our deliberations over the last 2 days is the word aspirational, right? So it is English. English is aspirational, and so on and so forth. What is the content? What is the content of aspiration in aspirational? What is, you know, what is this aspiration which English in some sense is addressing? Is it in some sense a kind of empty space? That it's left at that, it is aspirational, but we are unclear. And it seems to me that this has to do with the kind of context in which, in fact, these linguistic hybridizations are happening, which is, you know, that the point that I made this morning English is at some level it's a kind of leveler. It is also a kind of context in which the play of hierarchy can be noticed, indexed, indeed most sensitively, so that, you know, one can work at it. And it occurred to me there then that, you know, that in this ambiguity of this language, which is both a leveler and a divider. Fundamentally, that can we interpret the growing popular currency of this kind of hybridized dialect in which everyone can participate and more or less believe that we are all more or less the same, except that I do not believe we are. I mean, a couple of years ago, I was sort of pitted in the way that our media like to do this. I was pitted against Gurcharan Das in a kind of, you know, English in India kind of situation. So Gurcharan Das was all for aspirational English, global participation, young workforce, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, all of that stuff. And I said basically that, you know, if everybody learnt English today, hierarchy would find other ways of asserting itself. That, you know, that it's not going to disappear. And I was rebuked very severely, and there were all kinds of letters, saying that I was completely, which is probably true, I was completely out of phase with aspirational India, and that young India was driven by forces that I did not understand. Probably true. This seminar has gone a long way to exposing me to those things. But more seriously, though, I wonder whether some of this kind of explosion of English, and indeed the kind of euphoria about English, you know, the sort of that this kind of flowering of democracy and so on, I don't know whether it has something to do with or is connected to other kinds of symbolic gratification which our system affords, that in some sense there might be some kind of relation between English euphoria and the failure of the democratic political project, that there is nothing else happening, but meanwhile, you know, you can hybridize easily in the privacy of your own home, indeed, and you can do it, you know, you can conquer the airwaves with your hybridization. But, you know, so it, whether there is some sort of connection between the euphoria of English and the failure of the democratic political project. So I'll stop here.
Thank you very much. Abhijit, last before we have another
मैं तो हिंग्लिश पर नहीं, हिंग्लिश की राजनीति के ऊपर बोलूंगा और हिंदी में ही बोलूंगा. दो दिन से अंग्रेजी चल रही है, उसका कोटा पूरा हो चुका है. और ये हिंदी, इंग्लिश की राजनीति मैंने पिछले दो दिन में ही सीखी है, क्योंकि इससे पहले मैंने पहले ही कहा था फ्रांसिस्का को धन्यवाद देते हुए कि मुझे इंग्लिश के बारे में ज़्यादा कुछ पता नहीं है और इस वर्कशॉप में मैं ऐसे बैठूंगा जैसे कि एक कक्षा है. और मैं एक बहुत अच्छा छात्र हूँ, मैं आपको यकीन दिलाता हूँ, खूब जम के मैं सीखता हूँ, बस थोड़ा मनमानी करता हूँ, जो मेरे सामने परोसा जाता है उसके अलावा भी कुछ सीख लेता हूँ थोड़ा बहुत. तो जब, और चूंकि मुझे सब कुछ इसी वर्कशॉप से हासिल हुआ है, इसलिए मैं बहुत हवाले दूंगा जो कल दो दिन में बातचीत हुई उन वक्ताओं की, और जो बातें कही गई, जो बहस हुई उसके भी हवाले दूंगा. जो पहली प्रस्तुति थी वो आयशा केदवई की थी, जो एक भाषा शास्त्रीय नजरिए से इंग्लिश का उन्होंने विवरण हम लोगों के सामने पेश किया. तो उन्होंने एक बहुत दिलचस्प थीसिस हमारे सामने रखी कि इंग्लिश दो भाषाओं के मिलने से बनती है. एक भाषा मैट्रिक्स लैंग्वेज होती है, जो कि जिसमें जो लिपि प्रदान करती है उसको, और उस वाक्य रचना प्रदान करती है, और दूसरी भाषा एम्बेडेड लैंग्वेज होती है, जो कि सार तत्व प्रदान करती है उसको, सार तत्व. तो जैसे ही ये बात कही गई, मैं पिछले जमाने में चला गया, स्वामी विवेकानंद के जमाने में. तो स्वामी विवेकानंद ने कहा था कि अगर इस देश को मजबूत बनाना है तो इस्लाम का शरीर ले लेना चाहिए और हिंदू धर्म का जो तत्व ज्ञान है वो सार ले लेना चाहिए. अगर इस्लाम, मोटे तौर पर उनके शब्द कुछ और थे लेकिन उनका अर्थ यही था. और इस बात को एक बहुत बड़ा सेकुलर वक्तव्य बनाकर जब से बाबरी मस्जिद टूटी है तब से पेश किया जा रहा है. सीपीआई के, भारतीय कम्युनिस्ट पार्टी के, प्रगतिशील आंदोलन के बड़े बड़े जो सिपहसालार हैं, खगेंद्र ठाकुर वगैरह, वो बार बार पेश करते हैं कि अगर इस्लाम का शरीर और हिंदुत्व का और हिंदू धर्म का अगर तत्व ज्ञान ले लिया जाए तो ये जो मैट्रिक्स लैंग्वेज और एम्बेडेड लैंग्वेज का जो रिश्ता है, ये समीकरण है, ये वैसा ही समीकरण है जैसा कि विवेकानंद ने हम लोगों के सामने पेश किया था कि हिंदी का शरीर ले लिया जाए और उसमें इंग्लिश की आत्मा डाल दी जाए. इंग्लिश का जो संज्ञानात्मक पक्ष है, इंग्लिश की जो ज्ञान मीमांसा है, जो भाषिक ज्ञान मीमांसा है, वो उसमें डाल दी जाए. तो मैं समझता हूँ विवेकानंद का वो वक्तव्य, जिसे एक सेकुलर वक्तव्य के रूप में पेश किया जाता है, वो एक घोर सांप्रदायिक वक्तव्य है आज के संदर्भ में. विवेकानंद के जमाने में नहीं था, आज के संदर्भ में एक घोर सांप्रदायिक वक्तव्य है. उसी तरीके से जो इंग्लिश है, भाषा वैज्ञानिक संरचना हमारे सामने पेश की गई है मैट्रिक्स लैंग्वेज की और एम्बेडेड लैंग्वेज की, इसके ऊपर एक सवाल उठाया जा सकता है कि कौन मुसलमान चाहेगा विवेकानंद की भाषा में कि उसके तत्वज्ञान को छोड़ दिया जाए, केवल उसका सोशल ऑर्गेनाइजेशन, उसका जो सामाजिक संरचना, सामाजिक संगठन है, वही ले लिया जाए. कोई मुसलमान ये नहीं चाहेगा, कोई भी मुसलमान इस तरह के प्रस्ताव पर सहमत नहीं हो सकता. उसी तरीके से कोई भी व्यक्ति जो हिंदी में पला बड़ा है, हिंदी इसकी भाषा है, जो हिंदी में व्यवहार करता है, वो कभी भी इस प्रस्ताव को स्वीकार नहीं कर सकता कि केवल हिंदी की वाक्य रचना, लिपि और उसका ढांचा ले लिया जाए और हिंदी का जो तत्व ज्ञान है, हिंदी की जो संज्ञानात्मक क्षमता है और हिंदी की जो ज्ञान मीमांसा है, वो पूरी तरीके से उस भाषा में से निकाल दी जाए और उसकी जगह अंग्रेजी की ज्ञान मीमांसा और अंग्रेजी का तत्व ज्ञान उसके अंदर डाल दिया जाए. उसको मैं सांप्रदायिक वक्तव्य कहता हूं आज के संदर्भ में. अब इसको क्या कहूं, ये आप लोग अभी जो विचार विमर्श होगा इसके बारे में थोड़ा जरूर बताइए. उसके बाद में जब नवभारत टाइम्स की इंग्लिश के ऊपर विचार किया जा रहा था, तो फिर एक बार मैं उसके जरिए इतिहास में गया 18वीं सदी में गया, जहां पर दिल्ली के और लखनऊ के जो फारसी के आलिम थे, और उसमें दिल्ली के आलिम का नाम था शाह हातिम, उनके नेतृत्व में मतरूकात की एक मुहिम चल रही थी। मतरूकात का मतलब होता है, हम जानते हैं, पर्जिंग यानी छटाई, एक भाषा से दूसरे शब्दों की छटाई और उसकी जगह कुछ दूसरे शब्दों को उस भाषा में जोड़ना। मतरूकात की मुहिम उर्दू में चल रही थी और उनका कहना था कि हम उर्दू को बिल्कुल भाखा के शब्दों से शुद्ध करके मानेंगे। हम ब्रज के, अवधी के, भोजपुरी के जितने भी उर्दू में शब्द हैं वो सब निकाल के बाहर कर देंगे, उसकी जगह फारसी और अरबी के शब्दों को ले आएंगे उसमें। और हम जानते हैं मतरूकात की उस मुहिम के कारण उर्दू का संबंध इन जनपदीय भाषाओं से तकरीबन समाप्त हो गया, और उस संबंध को वापस लाने के लिए आज तक उर्दू में वैसी ही उस उतनी ही तरह की शक्तिशाली कोई मुहिम नहीं चली है। जब हम भारत टाइम्स की इंग्लिश देखते हैं तो मुझे वही मतरूकात की मुहिम याद आती है। ये तो मतरूकात से भी ज्यादा भीषण मुहिम है। इसमें तो एक अंग्रेजी हिंदी के एक वाक्य में केवल क्रियापद रह गए हैं, है और काकी रह गया है, बाकी सब कुछ निकाल लिया गया है, उसमें कुछ बचा ही नहीं है हिंदी के नाम पर। तो ये जो 18वीं सदी में मतरूकात चली थी फारसी के आलिमों के नेतृत्व में, और जिसका शिकार वली दक्कनी जैसे कवि को बनना पड़ा था, वली दक्कनी वहां से आए थे दिल्ली में कविता लिखने के लिए उर्दू में, तो जब उन्होंने फारसी के आलिमों को अपनी कविता सुनाई तो उन्होंने कहा कि तुम्हारे ख्याल तो अच्छे हैं लेकिन जरा ये कुछ तुम्हारी ये जो गजाला सू कहूंगा वगैरह ये सब जो हैदराबादी ये जो मामला है इसको छोड़िए, आप बाकायदा पर्शनाइज्ड उर्दू में फारसी कृत और अरबी कृत उर्दू के अंदर शायरी कीजिए। तो वली दक्कनी पे बहुत बड़ा दबाव पड़ा और बाद में उस दबाव के सामने झुक गए और उन्होंने वैसी शायरी करनी शुरू कर दी। तो ये दो चीजें, दो कल के दो जो प्रस्तुतियां थी उसने मुझे इतिहास की यात्रा करने पर मजबूर किया। जो दूसरा मुद्दा मैं आपके सामने उठाना चाहता हूं और जो मैंने सीखा है इसी से, जब फ्रांसिस्का अब बहुत एक अपना छोटा सा लेकिन बहुत अच्छा अच्छी प्रस्तावना पेश कर रही थी, तो उन्होंने कहा था कि इंग्लिश हमारे बीच में मुद्दतों से है, न जाने कब से है, लेकिन अब नई बात क्या है ये हम इस वर्कशॉप में पता लगाएंगे, व्हाट इज न्यू अबाउट इट। तो मैंने भी कुछ सोच पता लगाने की कोशिश की है कि नया क्या है। मतलब जो है मेरा विचार है नया ये है कि अभी तक पिछले 20 साल में 15-20 साल में जब से इंग्लिश की पैरोकारी बढ़ी है और इंग्लिश का दौर दौरा बढ़ा है, उसके पहले इंग्लिश लगातार स्पोकन लैंग्वेज में बोली हुई भाषा के दायरों में ही थी। वो एक वाचिक परंपरा की चीज थी जो ढीले ढाले ढंग से जिसका बर्ताव किया जाता था और उसके ऊपर उसे विशेष रूप से कहीं भी अकादमी रूप से रेखांकित नहीं किया जाता था। लेकिन अब दो बातें नई हो रही हैं। पहली यह है कि इंग्लिश को टेक्स्ट प्रोड्यूस करने वाली भाषा के रूप में पेश किया जा रहा है और उसके जरिए इंग्लिश को देश की एक नई लिंक लैंग्वेज, एक नई संपर्क भाषा के रूप में पेश किया जा रहा है। आप इंटरनेट पर जाइए, इस वर्कशॉप में आने के दो दिन पहले से मैंने इंटरनेट पर खूब सर्फिंग की और इतनी उसके अंदर प्रविष्टियां मिलती हैं कि दिस इज द मोस्ट इफेक्टिव लिंक लैंग्वेज ऑफ इंडिया नाउ। बड़े पैमाने पर इंग्लिश अभी तक जो संपर्क भाषा की पूरी राजनीति थी वो हिंदी और अंग्रेजी के बीच में सीमित थी। लोग अपनी मातृभाषा के अलावा दूसरी सबसे प्रिय भाषा कौन सी होगी, जब भारत की जनगणनाओं में यह सवाल पूछा जाता था 1960 से लेकर 1990 के बीच की जनगणनाओं का मैंने अध्ययन किया है, जब यह सवाल पूछा जाता था तो लोग जवाब देते थे भाई कि उससे पता लग जाता था कि हिंदी तमिल सीखने वाला तेलुगु इसकी मातृभाषा है, कन्नड़ इसकी मातृभाषा है, मराठी इसकी मातृभाषा है, गुजराती इसकी मातृभाषा है, वो दूसरी सबसे पसंदीदा भाषा कौन मानता है अपनी, अंग्रेजी मानता है कि हिंदी मानता है या कोई और भाषा मानता है। उसके जरिए पता लगता था कि दरअसल कौन सी भाषा जो है वो एक संपर्क भाषा के रूप में उभर रही है। तो 60 के दशक की जब जनगणना पर नजर डालते हैं तो आप पाते हैं कि उसमें पूरे गैर हिंदी भाषी इलाकों में दक्षिण भारत में लगभग कोई नहीं कहता कि हिंदी हमारी दूसरी पसंदीदा भाषा है, ज्यादातर लोग अंग्रेजी का नाम लेते हैं। लेकिन जैसे जैसे 60 के दशक से आप आगे बढ़ते हैं हिंदी बड़े पैमाने पर दक्षिण भारत में उभरनी शुरू हो जाती है, सामने आनी शुरू हो जाती है और 90 के दशक तक आते आते अंग्रेजी के जो बड़े बड़े मुकाम है संपर्क भाषा के, कम से कम जनगणना के आंकड़ों का यह मानना है, और तथ्य आंकड़े क्या मुझे नहीं पता, भारत की जनगणना ये बताती है, और इस बात को ग्राफों और तालिकाओं द्वारा मैं अपने एक लेख में दिखा भी चुका हूं कि हिंदी बड़े पैमाने पर कई जगह अंग्रेजी यहां आगे थी उससे, उन तमाम गैर हिंदी भाषी इलाकों में हिंदी या तो उसके बराबर आ गई है एक दूसरी पसंदीदा भाषा के तौर पर, या उससे आगे निकल गई है। तो जब एक ऐसी स्थिति में अब बड़ी अदा के साथ मैं इस संस्था में पिछले 15 साल से काम कर रहा हूं, और इससे पहले मैंने कभी भी किसी के मुंह से नहीं सुना था कि अंग्रेजी इस भारत की ही एक अन्य भाषा है। हम लोग अंग्रेजी को एक विदेशी भाषा के रूप में ही जानते थे। जब से मैं CSDS में आया हूं तभी से मैंने सुनना शुरू किया है कि भाई इंग्लिश इज अनदर इंडियन लैंग्वेज। अब ये सब जो बात बड़ी अदा से कही जाती है, जब मैं इसकी जांच पड़ताल करता हूं तो मैं पाता हूं कि तमाम कोर्सों के बावजूद, तमाम रेपिडेक्स इंग्लिश स्पीकिंग कोर्सेस के बावजूद, और अंग्रेजी को एस्पिरेशनल सॉलिडिटी की या एस्पिरेशनल लैंग्वेज साबित करने की तमाम कोशिशों के बावजूद, अंग्रेजी अभी तक इस देश की भाषा नहीं बन पाई है, बावजूद उसके कि अंग्रेजी में साहित्य अकादमी पुरस्कार भी दिया जाता है। अंग्रेजी इस देश की भाषा नहीं बन पाई है। अब अंग्रेजी इस देश की भाषा कैसे बन सकती है? अंग्रेजी इस देश की भाषा इस तरह बन सकती है, और दूसरी तरफ जनगणना के आंकड़े बताते हैं कि संपर्क भाषा बढ़ने की होड़ में हिंदी उसे बहुत जबरदस्त प्रतियोगिता दे रही है, यहां तक अंग्रेजी कई जगह उससे पिछड़ती हुई नजर आ रही है। जो मीडिया की दुनिया है, मनोरंजन की दुनिया है, अखबारों की दुनिया है, रीडरशिप सर्वे की दुनिया है, टीवी चैनलों की दुनिया है, आप कहीं भी देख लीजिए, रवीश कुमार के एक कार्यक्रम NDTV पर जो 1 घंटे का कार्यक्रम होता है, उसका दर्शक वर्ग इतना बड़ा है जितना अंग्रेजी के सभी चैनलों के दर्शक वर्ग को आप मिला दीजिए, उससे भी ज्यादा बड़ा दर्शक वर्ग उसका है। आप अखबारों को देख लीजिए, कहां है अंग्रेजी का अखबार? 9वें नंबर पे है, 10वें नंबर पे है नेशनल लीडरशिप सर्वे में। तो मैं ये हिंदी का जो डेमोग्राफिक डिविडेंट है, मैं केवल इसका जोर नहीं डाल रहा हूं, मैं ही बता रहा हूं जो परिस्थितियां हैं वो ये परिस्थितियां हैं। अब अंग्रेजी पिछड़ती जा रही है। अब इस दौड़ में जो संपर्क भाषा बनने की राजनीति है, इस राजनीति की दौड़ में अंग्रेजी अपना दावा किस तरह से पेश करेगी? अंग्रेजी अपना दावा इस तरह से पेश करती है कि वो संपर्क भाषा के रूप में एक तीसरा तत्व उस भोड़ में शामिल करती है, और अचानक 10-12 साल में हमारे सामने ये बात आती है कि इस देश की सबसे प्रभावी संपर्क भाषा ना हिंदी है ना अंग्रेजी है, हिंदी तो है ही नहीं, वो है क्या? इंग्लिश। इस बात को बार बार लगातार विभिन्न मुकामों से, विभिन्न मंचों से इस बात को कहा जा रहा है और इस बात को साबित करने की कोशिश की जा रही है। और जो इंग्लिश है उसमें हिंदी की क्या स्थिति है, हम इसी वर्कशॉप में देख चुके हैं। अब फ्रांसिस्का को इस बात पे बहुत आपत्ति हुई कि मैं भारत टाइम्स की इंग्लिश से जो जोया का संसार है उसकी इंग्लिश की तुलना कर रहा हूं। जब आप कोड मिक्सिंग की और आप कोड स्विचिंग की बात करते हैं तो उस कोड मिक्सिंग और कोड स्विचिंग को क्वांटिफाई तो किया ही जाएगा, आखिरकार ये तो पता लगाया ही जाएगा कि क्या मिलाया जा रहा है, क्या स्विच ऑन किया जा रहा है, क्या चीज छोड़ी जा रही है, क्या चीज जोड़ी जा रही है, और इस पूरी प्रक्रिया में क्या चीज बन रही है। जैसे कभी आलोक जी ने कहा कि वो पुश और पुल फैक्टर क्या है, किस चीज को धक्का देकर अलग किया जा रहा है और किस चीज की तरफ खींचा जा रहा है, मैग्नेट कहां है, किस चीज की तरफ हम खींचे जा रहे हैं, ये चीज बिल्कुल साफ तौर पर सामने आती है। अब आप जो जोया का संसार है उसके अंदर तो जो आयशा जी ने कहा था मैट्रिक्स लैंग्वेज और एम्बेडेड लैंग्वेज का फार्मूला भी बदल गया है वहां पर। जैसे ही आप अंग्रेजी की दुनिया की इंग्लिश के ऊपर गौर करते हैं वहां यह फार्मूला भी नहीं लागू होता, वहां तो मैट्रिक्स लैंग्वेज भी अंग्रेजी है और एम्बेडेड लैंग्वेज भी अंग्रेजी है, वहां हिंदी केवल इटैलिक्स में मौजूद है या उसको इटैलिक्स में करके देखा जा सकता है, उसको इटैलिक्स में करके हाईलाइट किया जा सकता है उसको। और आप जानते हैं जब भाषा हो या कोई चीज हो इटैलिक में हो जाती है तो एक तिरछा धरातल तैयार हो जाता है, एक ढलान तैयार हो जाता है, हमें देखना होगा इस ढलान पर कौन चढ़ रहा है और कौन उतर रहा है। हिंदी के अक्षरों को तिरछा करने से ढलान जो बना है, इस ढलान पर कौन उतर रहा है, कौन चढ़ रहा है, मुझे साफ दिखाई पड़ रहा है कि हिंदी इस पर उतर रही है और अंग्रेजी इसके ऊपर चढ़ रही है। अब मैं सिर्फ इन बातों को और सामने रखू, दूसरे एक बात अक्सर कही जाती है कि भाई जो इंग्लिश है वो एक सोशल फेनोमेना है, और कुछ इस खूबसूरती से इस बात को कहा जाता है कि सोशल फिनोमेना ने अपने आप को खुद प्रकट कर दिया है अपनी ताकत से, इसको कहीं से लाया नहीं गया है, इस सोशल फिनोमेना को गढ़ा नहीं गया है। कम से कम इस वर्कशॉप ने तो इस धारणा की कलाई खोल दी है। इस वर्कशॉप के हर पेपर ने बार बार आपके जो फेलोज हैं उन्होंने बार बार अपने जो रिसर्च मटेरियल हम लोगों के सामने पेश किया है उसमें बताया है कि इंग्लिश बाकायदा सुचिंतित रूप से एक उद्देश्य, उस उद्देश्य को चिन्हित नहीं किया गया है, उस उद्देश्य के तहत गढ़ी जा रही है इंग्लिश, मतलब जो है मैं केवल उसी उद्देश्य को चिन्हित करने की कोशिश कर रहा हूँ। और एस्पिरेशनल लैंग्वेज क्या है? कोई भी भाषा कभी भी जमीन की उस इलाके की भाषा नहीं बन सकती अगर उसका वास्ता केवल आर्थिक आकांक्षाओं से है, केवल नौकरियों के अवसरों से है। भाषाएं तभी उस जमीन की भाषा बनती हैं जब वो इनके परे जाती हैं। धन्यवाद।